You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Christina Geist.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show lined up for you. Before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about some sponsors today. Crystal Pico Watanabe at Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. She's got a team of 8 people who help provide services to fiction authors. And she has a full slate of services that now include beta reading. She's got 4 beta readers now. So if you're looking for beta reading services, she can definitely take on your project. Manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors can also inquire about putting their books in her Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. It's free to authors for a limited time. Be sure to check out Crystal and her whole team at Pico's House. That's PikkosHouse.com. Thanks, Crystal, for sponsoring the show. While Cape and Spandex movies are breaking box office records, comic book commentator and influencer Ed Gosney doesn't want us to forget the roots of these marvelous wonders. His blog, Cool Comics in My Collection, at edgosney.com, covers the gamut of four-color entertainment, from contemporary comic books to comics made for kids to bargain bin gold to classics that will transport you back in time. Comic books are a perfect blend of art and story, and Cool Comics captures the essence of what these funny books mean to us in a personal way. And make sure to join the Cool Comics in My Collection Facebook group, where members can interact, show off their prized comics, and have opportunities to win, you guessed it, Cool Comics. Published weekly, Cool Comics in My Collection aims to bring you a smile and reminds us why comic books are fun. Be sure to visit edgosney.com today. Speaking of superheroes and comics, my friend Patricia Gillum has a fantastic series called The Heroes of Corvus. It begins with book 1, a flight between a second-generation superhero named Red Bolt and a villain-for-hire named Icarus goes terribly wrong, resulting in the drowning deaths of 3 innocent civilians and orphaning a 6-year-old boy. Racked with guilt, Red Bolt visits Cameron Wilson at the hospital every night and won't leave the boy's side until he falls asleep. Befriended by a night shift nurse, the man in costume begins to disclose what really happened after the fight and why he feels the deaths of Cameron's parents and sister fall on his actions. A superhero didn't survive that night, and Cameron and the rest of the city aren't out of danger. This is such a phenomenal story. She has released up to part 4 now, and I cannot wait for part 5 to come out. If you're looking for a great adventure read that's on the cutting edge of what is in today's entertainment, The Heroes of Corvus is the series for you by Patricia Gillum. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to go to HankGarner.com to subscribe to the show. We're on just about every platform you can imagine. Now stay tuned for our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Christina Geist on the show with me today. She has a fantastic new children's book called Sorry Grown-Ups, You Can't Go to School. And this book has been out for a couple of weeks now and debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. Welcome to the show, Christina.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you. We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
And it's a great question. For me, I have a few that I can call up. My dad always says that he can picture his life in snapshots. And so one of my snapshots is just when I was young. I have an older sister, Allison, who's 3 years older than me, and Allison and I and our friends in the neighborhood, Amy, Karen, our girlfriends, that all kind of lived within close proximity of our first family home, we would put on performances all the time. So storytelling through, toddler and kindergartner plays and performances kind of in the backyard and in the basement is probably first and foremost my earliest memory of storytelling. Writing wise, I do remember writing my first book with, you know, quotes around it in third grade in Mrs. Miller's classroom. It was about a cat and a mouse. I wrote and illustrated it, and it is somewhere in the attic. And this question comes up, and I have got to fish it out of the attic and read it again. But yeah, I think it would be about third grade.
I love that. I love that so much. You said that your dad says that he can envision his life in pictures and still shots. Was there a strong storytelling tradition in your family?
You know, I think not as much storytelling as big characters.
Yeah.
So my and my mom's side of the family in particular, there were so many and still are just really big characters in our narrative. And my mom lost actually both of her parents by the time she was 30. So a lot of our memories of our grandparents on my mother's side are strictly through storytelling. And that's how we've gotten to know them still over my entire lifetime. My great-grandmother, who was my grandmother's mother, so she outlived her own daughter for many years, my great-grandmother, our Nana, was a very big presence in our life. And there were a lot of stories around, you know, her lifetime and all that had happened in family history. And so I think it was less so that we were sitting around listening to stories or that I had any real kind of writers in the family, and more that just the act of storytelling through the characters on both sides of my family has always been, you know, a big part of our family history for sure.
Right. And that's one reason why I make a distinction between storytellers and writers. I think there are certain people that story just comes naturally to them, and that may be expressed in all sorts of different ways. And some people decide to take that and then pursue a writing career out of that. And some people are just these larger than life characters that that invade our lives in this beautiful way.
Yeah, I agree. And I think those things can be quite challenging. So you could be a great oral storyteller, you know, someone sitting around with friends rehashing a moment. And I feel like among groups of friends or in certain families, there's sort of a designated lead storyteller.
Right.
You know, the person who either remembers that detail the funniest or who can do the impression of the person who's, you know, the lead in that particular tale. And so the act of storytelling is definitely one thing. To sit and write it, though, is really different. And I often, I love reading novels, and I love reading longer form stories. I'm not sure that I could easily sit down and write a full novel. I think that's a certain skill that is, it's a beautiful thing when people can do it. But it's something that doesn't come as easily to me. So I'm always also, like you, I'm always impressed in how, and figuring out people's process and kind of how they, you know, how they can sit and weave a narrative in the way that they do.
I know you went to college at Vanderbilt, but where did you grow up?
Yes, I grew up in Ridgewood, New Jersey, actually. So
okay.
I went from New Jersey to Nashville. my husband and I actually grew up in the same hometown. We met in sixth grade in middle school homeroom, and went to school together all the way through middle school and high school in our hometown of Ridgewood, New Jersey. I'll actually be there for a book signing tomorrow at our hometown bookstore. So that's always exciting to go back. But we grew up about 30 minutes outside of New York City. So Manhattan was our version of the city. And within reach, but definitely felt quite far away, in that we were from a pretty kind of classic suburban town, a train ride away from New York City, some parents getting on that train, commuting in and out every day, a big public high school. There were about 400 kids in my graduating class, and a strong emphasis on actually on writing, in our curriculum from an early age. I can remember a strong focus on grammar, on sentence structure, on vocabulary. In ninth grade, we had a lot of vocabulary that we were learning. and kind of a lot of rigor going into the appreciation for being a strong writer. So I really credit my Ridgewood, New Jersey, public school education preparing me for life in a lot of different ways. Because I do believe that if you can sit down and communicate your thought in writing, that you are, you know, on your way in life to being able to do so many different careers, so many different things, if you can get your thoughts out in an articulate way. But yeah, the leap to Nashville, Tennessee was a big one to Vanderbilt, for sure.
Yeah. Was that a big culture shock, or do you feel like the small town atmosphere that you grew up in transitioned easily?
I think it was pretty smooth. I at the time that it was 1993 when I started Vanderbilt my freshman year, and the school was not as geographically diverse as it is now. It was also, thankfully for us, not as competitive as it is now. I don't know that I would be able to get in if I applied now as my 18-year-old self, but luckily I did. And I loved it. I loved meeting people from all over the country. I found that most of my classmates were really similar. People had come from a lot of them pretty similar suburban backgrounds. It was just a suburb outside of a different city. So upon graduating, it was actually really great and really liberating in that I knew I could move anywhere in the country and I would have a friend there. And I still feel that way 25 years later. We've got friends all over the country. I understand the South. I understand small town Alabama and Atlanta and places that some of my fellow New Yorkers really don't understand. I've spent time in Texas. I love it. But, you know, it's a different world when you go from New York City to Texas, you know. So having friends and people that I know all over the country has definitely enriched my life in a great way.
You mentioned your husband grew up in the same small town that you did. He's a name that we might have heard of before. Your husband is Willie Geist, right?
Correct. Yes.
I love it. Do you guys have, being both people in creative type endeavors, do you find that the that in raising your own family and do you find that you find ways to challenge your kids creatively?
Yeah, definitely. I don't know that I try to challenge them as much as there's just a certain kind of atmosphere in a household where you're producing things, you know, that are watchable or readable or, you know, kind of tangible to young kids, and that our work is not for either of us this kind of faraway thing that the kids sort of see us leave and never know what we're up to on the other side of that doorway, and that they can turn on the TV and watch their dad, or they can read his books. He and his father wrote a book together called Good Talk Dad a few years ago. My father, Bill Geist, is a prolific writer and has written many books and was a correspondent for CBS Sunday Morning for many, many years, and was a writer for the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune before that as a columnist. So in Willie's family history, it's definitely a clear line from kind of father to son in terms of creative talent, and particularly writing and producing content for the rest of the world to enjoy. In my family, my parents are both very, very strong writers, but they are in different careers. My mom works in corporate sales and in language training. My father is a lawyer. So they were always using their words, but just in a different direction. And so I think for us as parents now, with our own two kids, we are always rewarding, first of all, their own creativity and their own sense of humor. We live in a pretty funny household, and my son in particular is really, really showing signs at age 10 of a sense of humor that's well beyond his years. And so, you know, I look at him and think, how do we cultivate this in him, you know, and should he be going to like improv classes for kids, or just letting him watch Will Ferrell sketches and letting him watch Jimmy Fallon and letting him listen to comedians, you know, in the car. Sometimes we put podcasts on. And my daughter is a very, very strong writer. She's entering seventh grade and has a really strong command of the written word for someone who's just 12 years old. So we're definitely looking out for that. I mean, I think to be a good parent is to kind of figure them out and watch and learn what's special and unique about them and what they're into, and then try to softly give them the right exposure and resources to chase after that. And in Willie's household, it was definitely, you know, the path his father had taken was not to go put on a suit and work in a bank. So I think he probably felt a little bit more liberated to work in television or in, you know, kind of a less traditional career.
Besides being a best-selling children's author, you also have another life in the corporate world. What kind of other work do you do?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I actually look at it in terms of kind of wearing three hats on any given day. I actually, my background career-wise, before I wrote any children's story down, was as I started out as a news writer, believe it or not, and that's the industry my husband's in now. I realized very early on that it was a really tough lifestyle to work in TV news. So I jumped ship and worked for a long time in public relations and corporate communications, and then ultimately in branding and marketing, where I was writing and doing creative writing and storytelling, but for a brand as opposed to for, you know, an audience. And so my career path really took me through different marketing organizations, ad agencies, branding agencies, package design agencies, where I was basically helping brands craft their story visually and verbally to then take that out into the world and connect with a consumer. So the business I run in that vein is called True Geist. My business partner's name is Todd True, so we call ourselves True Geist. He's a designer and I'm the writer. And we counsel brands and help them name themselves, design their packaging, design their products. I name products. I develop the storyline behind a new offering, or help refresh it for something that exists and maybe just needs a little bit of fresh air. And that business supports a startup that I run, which is called Boombox Gifts. And those are memory boxes that, you know, I think storytelling carries through in everything I do. And it just so happened that when I was turning 40 and my friends were all turning 40, the same year my father was turning 70, I started to make memory boxes for them and capture and collect letters from everyone I could track down over email in their life, from their old boss to their big brother or college roommates, and just collect all these messages and put them inside a beautiful box and basically give them their life story as a gift, told back to them by the people they've touched along the way. And
oh,
that
my goodness. I love that
now,
so much.
Oh, thanks. It's a beautiful thing to wake up every day and help people do this for each other. There was no business to help me do it, so I figured out that I could do my day job at True Geist, and I could take all my paychecks and I could write them into a bank account that was for Boombox Gifts, and I could launch a business that way. And so I've self-funded or angel-funded my own startup for the last 4.5 years. And Boombox is now almost 4 years old, and we've created thousands of boxes for people all over the world at all different points in life. Happy moments like birthdays, but also more reflective moments like memorials or when someone's diagnosed with an illness and their village wants to gather around and give them some love. So those are my two kind of hats I wear at work. And then my writing, my children's books are, you know, not, I wouldn't say a hobby because there's more to it than that, but it's kind of my writing that's for me, and for my little buddies, my little friends, out there who are reading.
The work that you do with brands to help them tell their story. I think a lot of people, overlook the importance of storytelling in our day-to-day business lives. Because when you're connecting with a product or a company, you really want to connect with people on an emotional level. And what better way to do that than storytelling? And storytelling takes on such non-traditional roles. I mean, we think of storytelling as either someone verbally communicating or a book that we're reading, but it really encompasses more than that. Could you just real quick just talk about your philosophy on how we connect with people through storytelling in things that we don't think of as storytelling mediums?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, what's interesting is right now we're at this really interesting kind of cultural moment where entrepreneurs are celebrities in a very interesting and dynamic way that it, I don't know that that was the case, it, you know, maybe even so far as like 20 years ago. But now we are as a culture, as tapped into who someone like Jeff Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos or even, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow launching the Goop brand or, you know, other kind of famous entrepreneurs out there who, or the founders of Warby Parker are a great example where they were in business school and discovered a need that, that eyeglasses were too expensive and solved that problem and in turn created this empire in Warby Parker that revolutionized the way people buy eyewear. So there are stories that are natural to a lot of businesses today because they're the founder's story. And so Boombox is a good example of that. Like Boombox is a founder story business where it relates directly to a challenge I had building something as a gift for the people I love. And because I couldn't build it right, I set out and built it myself. So there are a lot of products and brands out there and experiences we're having, or Tom's Shoes, where, you know, the one-for-one model of buying a pair of shoes and donating a pair of shoes to a child in need. We are all kind of purchasing products right now based on the story that we feel or the connection we feel, or in some cases rejecting things, right? So people are having a reaction to Amazon maybe, or they're having a reaction to Facebook that then kind of does connect back to that person because they're related to the founder. Other brands that we know and love, we might not know that story behind them. So if you've been buying, you know, Tide detergent forever, you might know that Procter & Gamble makes Tide detergent, right? And so there's a big sort of corporate entity behind that. So the storytelling for a brand like Tide isn't going to come from the narrative all the way back to whoever invented it, but it's going to come through the people that are using it today. So, you know, Procter & Gamble, when they sponsor the Olympics, they talk about moms, and they talk about the moms of Olympians and the relationship that they have with their child and then all of a sudden also with these products. So storytelling coming through, it's always come through in advertising. That's been the natural way for brands to connect to consumers in an emotional way, not just in a product benefit way. So this tastes good or this is going to work well. So we're used to it in advertising. And I think the really cool space now is that it's become much, much more than that. And consumers are turning packages over and reading the back, and they want to know where things come from and who makes them and why I should believe in that and why you're sort of worthy of my $5 or $10 or $500, you know, depending on what it is that you're buying. So it's a really great play space for me as a professional because I get to do the work I love to do, which is to create and come up with the right combination of words or come up with the right way to express an idea or a thought. And I'm just doing that on a much larger scale than in a story. But it's all kind of the same muscle that you're flexing on a daily basis.
Well, alongside that fascinating work that you're doing comes in 2016, your first children's book, Buddy's Bedtime Battery, and you've just followed it up, as we mentioned earlier, with your brand new book, Sorry, Grown-Ups, You Can't Go to School. What triggered this third career for you, and what was the inspiration for that first book?
Yeah, I mean, it actually, the whole thing started when I took a career break from everything else. So when my kids were 3 and 1, I jumped ship. I was working at Johnson & Johnson at the time in the global strategic design office, and I was a strategist there. So I was a strategist on the baby brands all over the world, helping them to, again, tell their story through design and through packaging and through branded communication. And I took a break. I left my job. I was home with my kids for 4 years. And all of a sudden, that creative energy had a different place to go. And in the years I was home with them, which are kind of crunch time years when you have 3 and a 1-year-old and you're in preschool, and I had never really been in a preschool classroom until my daughter was in preschool and then my son. And they're fascinating places, and little people are amazing and they're hilarious, especially when they're not yours. because when they're yours, you can be sort of stuck in the moment of whatever your challenge is at that particular day. But there is this kind of joyful inspiration of just being on the playground every day. And we live in New York City, so we can be on a different playground, you know, 3 times a day. There's so much diversity of what you can do with little kids in the city. And you're just interacting with people all the time, and these moments of everyday life started to look like stories to me. And I just kind of had these characters dancing around in my head, Lady and Buddy, they're a brother and sister. And by the time my kids were 3 and 5, I promised myself that I would sit down and write them all down. And so I actually had almost like a creative sprint in the fall of, let's see, they were 3 and 5. So 2012, so 7 years ago, I sat down when I had free time that school year, and I wrote about 10 different manuscripts, stories about these characters. And they were all moments in time and moments in everyday life that I just saw a little bit differently. So the bedtime story is just a little bit of a different take on bedtime than I had been reading at home. And the same with Sorry, Grown Up.
I love how noticing these moments, but then finding a way to convey them or to look at these moments with a different set of eyes. That's what makes kids' books so magical. And so many people have tried to write books for kids and think that it is super simple because they tend to be shorter than novels and that sort of thing. And, I can crank out some kids' books and I can, make this happen. And they are confronted very quickly by just how difficult it is. And then if you finish one and then actually put it in front of kids, they will skewer you for realizing just how insincere that they are most of the time. What is it? Can you put your finger on what it is about that keen eye that lets you see a kid's story in a fresh way that will actually resonate with kids?
Yes, I totally agree. They are the toughest audience. I mean, they will fall asleep, literally. They will fall asleep. They will lie down on the carpet. They'll get up and leave the room. I mean, you have to really
yes.
work. You have got to work to keep these guys interested. So it is a great pressure test to put something on paper. And you don't need pictures. You can sit in a room with, depending on who your audience is, you can sit in a room with 10 4-year-olds and say, I have an idea. Can I give you the idea? Can you give me a thumbs up or thumbs down? And they will do it. They don't need pictures. They'll tell you right away. And then if it's good, they'll start to co-create with you. And they'll start to imagine, oh, what if the dog did this? Or, what if he did that? So I think for me, one of the tricks is to really write for something to be read aloud. Picture books are written to be read aloud. So in Buddy's Bedtime Battery, the first page of the book is, I am not a boy, yells Buddy, looking in the mirror at his new jammies. I am a robot. I am Ro-Buddy. And I read it like that. And then I say to my friends, does this look like a robot to you? And they say, no, he's not a robot. He's a boy. But what's he doing? He's pretending. And that's how we set the stage for reading the story. I could have started that book with, it was bath time at Buddy's house, and when he got out of the tub, once again, he put on his robot pajamas and demanded to be called Ro-Buddy. That's how a grown-up would sit down and set a scene, but that's not how you need to capture a three-year-old. You know, you have to capture a three-year-old in their voice right out of the gate. I am not a boy. And all caps, I am not. Because a three-year-old says not about 500 times a day. All they do is tell you what they're not going to do. You know, you pick up a three-year-old at preschool and they walk out the door and they're all smiles with their teacher. And the minute they come out and see you, they say, I'm not going to eat my lunch or I'm not going to take my nap. And you're like, wait a minute, where was all the happiness? You know, so you have to really know your audience, and then you have to know what makes them tick and how to speak to them in their language and in their voice. And I think that that's what is the difficult part is with a children's book. Whatever you're putting in quotes, in quotation marks, has got to genuinely come out of the mouth of whomever it's coming out of, you know? And so even in Sorry Grown-Ups, everyone's trying to go to school, and the grown-ups are all trying to go to school. And it's just, you know, of course they can't go to school. Only kids and teachers can go. And then, after mom, dad, and grandparents, all of a sudden there's a page where the dog, Bow Wow, just on the whole page, a full spread, says, woof, 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 says Bow Wow. Woof, 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 woof. And all of a sudden, you know, well, that's Bow Wow trying to convince Lady that he wants to go to school too. And, you know, so when you get to that page, everybody's like, oh, well, of course Bow Wow's going to talk now. This makes perfect sense, you know, because that makes perfect sense to a 3 or 4 or 5 year old. And all the grownups are sort of looking at me like, what? You know, a full page spread of a 40 page book, that's a lot of real estate to use for a dog trying to
right.
talk. But
so it's being consistent with the. So is it being consistent with the rules that you created in the beginning, and those rules being, this is what an actual 3-year-old would do?
Yeah, and this is what this is how to tell them a story. You know, I think as adults, we tend to explain our way through life, right? Like everything has kind of a rational explanation, and it doesn't always work to communicate with a child, either in a moment of discipline or in a fun moment of storytelling, to explain it. Sometimes you just have to do it, you know, and jump into that character and get into the narrative with them. And that's actually part of the philosophy behind Buddy's Bedtime Battery, the first book, is that at the end of the day, when you have a 3-year-old who's still in character, because they're in character all day, they're never really themselves. They're always someone or something else. And it can be exhausting by the end of the day. You just want them to be themselves and go to bed at that point. And so there are a lot of books that are written about that conflict, the bedtime conflict. So one of my favorites is a Little Critters book in the series called Just Go to Bed. And you can imagine what it's about. And I love it. And it's hilarious because the child is in all these different imaginary moments. And the father is saying, but just go to bed, right? So, and Dinosaur Versus Bedtime. There are a lot of conflict bedtime books, and they're great. This one's a little different in Buddy, in that the whole family just jumps along and gets into the narrative with Buddy, who's Row Buddy. And beats him and powers him down for bed. And it's a real technique that I needed at the time when my kids were little, because they moved to big kid beds out of cribs, and they were wandering around the house. And there was no way for me to explain, like, this is over now. You're done. You can't get out of, you know, they used to not be able to get out of a crib. Well, now they're out of this bed, and there's no way for me to help them conceptualize that it's over now. We've done the routine. And we're turning you off now for bed, which is a real technique called progressive muscle relaxation that you use to gradually relax your muscle groups and release stress and tension and get yourself ready for a state of relaxation. And the way for me to conceptualize that for my own toddler was to beep, 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 turn off her little muscle groups. So there's a real technique in the story, but you're not going to, you know, you're not going to trick a 3-year-old into that with, you know, straight up prose. You got to really get into character.
Well, where I live, we are ramping up to begin school back next week. Everyone's buying school supplies and all of that kind of stuff. And you know, the return to school is on everyone's mind. The new book, Sorry Grownups, You Can't Go to School. What was the motivation for this book, and why did you choose to tackle, going back to school?
Yes, well, so like Buddy, this one was written for a moment in time that I just didn't see with this voice in my own life when I was buying a lot of these books that are out on the tables right now. And I noticed with my own kids, it is a struggle, and it's a new struggle every year. I always say, if you can imagine as a grown-up that you had to start a new job with a new boss in a new office space with completely new responsibilities, every single September, go. You would be anxious, right? And so it's an overwhelming time for kids. And there are a lot of stories that have been written, and many of them written beautifully, to talk about those feelings. I call them the three S's. Someone's feeling sad or shy or scared. And so when I was feeling that way and my kids were feeling that way, I was turning to a lot of those books, but I felt like they were highlighting the emotions that we wanted to kind of not focus on. And so I saw a space for this different kind of a book, this different kind of back to school book. And the inspiration for the narrative came when my daughter was actually starting a little summer camp the summer she was 3 years old. Not back to school just yet, but it was a little summer camp. And I was trying to get her ready to go and just started to tell everyone around the house that I was terribly sorry, but they were not going to be able to go to camp, just loud enough for her to overhear. And then she sort of pricked up and started to hear. And I would say, only Lucy can go to camp. I'm very sorry. I know you're trying to go, but you're not invited. And, we would just sort of do this around the house. And of course, then everybody would cry and beg. And all of a sudden, it became this sort of funny game that developed into this whole chant and this whole kind of like rallying cry. And so I would sort of touch on that philosophy of rejecting me or rejecting everybody else whenever it was time to go somewhere new. So if I tried to go and put myself in kind of a ridiculous situation, either trying to put this tiny little like ladybug toddler backpack on or packing a lunch or trying to put her shoes on my feet, these new school shoes, I'm going to wear these, all this stuff that just was ridiculous for her, for a little person, for my son later, it tended to help me just sort of cut the tension a bit. And so that's where the inspiration for this story came from, was kind of twofold. One was, I didn't see a book like this. It wasn't there for me on the table or at the library, and I needed it. And then secondly, we had this kind of funny moment ourselves at home, and those two things sort of converged into this story, which begins, it seems like any other school day, but as soon as Lady and her brother Buddy were dressed and eating breakfast, things started to get a little weird. And then you can imagine where we go from there.
Christina, I absolutely love what you're doing. Not only the books are fantastic, but the way you approach them is such a breath of fresh air. Will we see more stories from these characters?
I hope so, yes. I mean, I have many manuscripts sitting on my laptop. I think in my heart, I'd love to see one more in this series to kind of round out the Lady and Buddy series. And so I'm working on kind of what's the right next manuscript. I've got a few that are already written that need to be refined a bit, and then think about what might be the next to kind of come, the best to come next. And then I've got lots of ideas. I mean, I'm jotting things down every day. I had this really just funny notion a couple of weeks ago about a really simple book that just had on each page, great idea. And, you can imagine there's a visual, an image of something that's a great idea. And then you turn the page and it says, ooh, bad idea. And then you turn the page and it says, that's a terrific idea. And then you turn it again. Yikes, not a good idea. And just these things that happen in life for little people. And so the tricky part for me is always figuring out then, you know, I don't illustrate. So I'm always daydreaming about what might be the scene to kind of go along with that. But I don't know whether that will be something like that would even have Lady and Buddy involved, or is that kind of a different, you know, different idea. But, you know, hopefully, you know, as my readers get older, new ones are born every day, and brothers and sisters are born every day. And I've been so touched by the response from teachers and educators and librarians for Buddy, and now particularly for Sorry Grown Ups, because they see a need for this in their own classrooms. And that's been especially humbling and heartwarming for me. And so I hope to continue to connect with all the teachers and librarians out there and bring them new stories that just kind of bring a fresh little take to their day.
Well, Buddy's Bedtime Battery and Sorry Grown Ups, You Can't Go to School are both available everywhere that you buy books. Fantastic, fantastic books. Christina, if people are just learning about you and want to find out more about you, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
Sure. The easiest place is actually just my own website, which is myname.com. It's just ChristinaGeist.com. And that will connect you through to everything we've talked about today.
Excellent. We'll put links to all of it in the show notes and a link where you can buy a copy of all of Christina's books. Christina, this has been so much fun chatting. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Hank, and thanks to all the listeners.
Thanks for tuning into the Author Stories podcast. Be sure to subscribe at hankgarner.com or on your favorite podcasting app. Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
"I'm melting! I'm melting!"
cried Joey.
"Take the picture already!"
He stood with one arm around the bronze waist of the bewitched tribute statue, Samantha Stevens, riding a broom across a crescent moon. Jason tried in vain to frame the shot without any tourists in it, but that was impossible. From all points of the compass, a merry horde had arrived for Salem's two-day summer psychic fair. All the commuter trains had burst open, like cornucopias filled beyond capacity, spilling endless fruits and nuts onto the red brick sidewalks of Essex Street. A vampiress in lavender shorts and feathered boots sold maple chocolate walnut fudge in front of the Witch City Tattoo Parlor. A near-naked gypsy in purple-green veils danced with a pheasant in her arms around a plug-in Hanukkah menorah. A fat man in a fetching blue jeans dress sold amethyst and citrine charm bracelets in front of Medusa Cafe, but his stand got knocked over by a one-armed crone driving a mobility scooter who sang choo-choo as she passed, her stump on the wheel, her lipstick ghastly, her gnarled right hand raised in trailing plumes of noxious cigarette smoke. Chewbacca leapt out of her way and slapped sparks from his fur. He gave a disgruntled growl before going back to playing Summer Lovin' on his ukulele. The old one-armed dervish drove off, choo-choo, parting a crowd of wanderers, slack-jawed tourists with camera straps tight across their bellies, yellow-vested police on segways, elderly rollerbladers, face-painted infants and harried parents, and college girls. So many hot, hysterical college girls that you'd think somebody had napalmed a sorority house.
"Jason, are you deaf?"
"Sorry." Jason raised the phone and took the shot. Joey inspected the photo and nodded in approval.
"Your turn."
"No, thanks."
"Do it, Shaggy. Don't make me hex you."
Jason gave in and traded places. He put an arm around Samantha's metal back. Her bronze body had flushed in the afternoon sun, warm through his glove, but her eyes were weary. No, downright creepy. And her smile was forced, like a Disneyland princess who'd had her toe stomped.
"Say chowda,"
cried Joey, who'd been practicing his New England accent all morning.
"Come on, man. Say chowda."
"Fine, chowda." Joey got the shot, and Jason surrendered Samantha to a chubby kid wearing a Gandalf beard who climbed up to worship her bronze bosom.